From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. You're in Washington, and you've got the plum assignment covering the White House. You might get to ride on Air Force One and travel the world with the president, but is it really as glamorous as it sounds? This hour, we'll talk with NPR's Tamara Keith and Bloomberg's Margaret Taliaferro about their experiences as White House correspondents. We'll discuss the challenges and the excitement of reporting on the president and what it's like to be in that briefing room. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today, a look at what it's like to have one of the most high-profile jobs in American journalism, White House correspondent. We'll talk about what makes a job glamorous and what's decidedly unglamorous about a job that requires its occupants to be on call 24/7. With us today are two respected members of the White House Press Corps. Tamara Keith is a White House correspondent for NPR. And Tamara, nice to have you. Good morning.
Glad to be with you. Thanks so much.
Margaret Taliaferro is the White House correspondent for Bloomberg. And Margaret, good morning to you, too.
Hi, Steve. Great to be with you.
And they both join us from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Tamara, did they pack you guys into one booth out there, or do you have separate booths?
I have to say it's pretty spacious, but we are in the same booth.
Okay. And you're not fighting yet, right?
Well, compared to our workspace at the White House, it is downright spacious.
Yes. And it's not in the basement.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
And there are no mice, but I mean, not that we're complaining.
Well, Tamara, is this job all that it's cracked up to be?
Well, so for the record, I'm pretty new to the job. I started 3 months ago, so it's all still new and shiny and bright to me. But I think that it probably is not as glamorous as everyone thinks it is. You know, I'm not like hanging out with the president or even hanging out with his chief of staff or his chief spokesman all that often. But, you know, you do go to work at the White House every day, which is kind of a crazy thing when you think about it. When you sort of walk through those gates, you're there.
Margaret, how about you?
As they say in The Godfather, it is the offer that you can't refuse, right? It is like sometimes the most frustrating job and you're sleep deprived. But when it's good, it's really, really good. And, you know, I'd say most days on balance, it's pretty amazing, even though you have less access than you'd like to have, even though you're always trying to get your head around what's really happening. And they throw up an awful lot of roadblocks to, you know, even though this administration strives for transparency when it talks to the public about its goals, they want journalists to be on their message and on their narrative. And it's often a real challenge. It's different than a regular reporting beat. But you are at a front seat to history. Every cliche like that you might hear is true when you're on that plane, when you're in China witnessing some historic meeting, or in Burma the first time a U.S. president rolls through with the motorcade, or even when you're just covering a fight with Congress, you realize that you're watching history happen. It's a great job.
Well, Tamara, you just alluded to this a few minutes ago, but you know, I think some people out there might assume that when they hear that you are a White House correspondent, that you know, you drop in to chat with a president, you know, just four or five times a day. How true is that?
That would be not true at all. You know, the president is a very busy guy, and chatting with us is not his idea of a good time.
How did you get that impression?
I think that there, you know, the relationship is one where obviously the White House needs us, and on some level we need them to tell the story of what they're doing. But it's an uneasy relationship, as it should be.
Well, Margaret, have either of you, and I'll begin with you, have either of you had, you know, an exclusive interview with the president inside the White House?
I've been covering President Obama since 2007, since the summer of 2007, when he was still a senator and, you know, those sort of early days of Iowa. And I have personally had precisely one one-on-one private sit-down interview with him, and it was in 2008. It lasted 11 minutes. It was on an airplane. Bloomberg has had a couple of, as an organization, interviews with him, but it is very difficult to get a one-on-one interview with him if you actually cover the White House on a daily basis. And you'll see him give all these interviews, like he's on 60 Minutes again, or he's doing interviews with local media in what just happened to be pivotal television markets for some initiative they're trying to pass. But when it comes to actually speaking one-on-one with the people whose job it is in and out day-to-day to cover him, those are very rare interviews indeed, and he does very few of them. If you actually unpacked the numbers and looked at everyone he talked to, they're mostly not people who actually cover him.
And in fact, NPR has gotten several interviews, I don't know the exact number, with the president over his terms, but those have all been done by the hosts, which of course, you know, our hosts are our very best interviewers, and of course that those interviews were done by the hosts. But you know, it wasn't the White House correspondents.
Well, White House correspondents, you know, as a group, have been on the president's case for a while for not making himself more available, Tamara. I mean, how big a problem has it been in your view?
Well, and there have been these issues where the president has a photographer who documents things that happen behind closed doors that we don't get access to. He takes incredible photos, but they are definitely pushed out with a purpose of getting the White House message out, of sort of spinning the message the way they want it to be spun. And as journalists, we don't get access to those places. And this has been an area of great contention, which Margaret actually knows more about because she's on the White House Correspondents Association.
Yeah, what about it, Margaret?
Certainly whether you're sort of managing access to the correspondents who cover you on a daily basis or managing access to the release of the images that people see, all of that really matters. Do I think it's possible to do a good job of covering the White House without having regular access to the president? Absolutely. And actually, if he were available to sit down with us every time we wanted him to, what would he really say that goes beyond what you hear him say? He's a very smart guy. He's certainly capable of staying on message. Realistically, it's not that if you had him in a one-on-one setting, he would, like, you know, have the truth lasso around him and open up and tell you what he's really thinking. So I think it's certainly possible to do a good job of covering the White House on a regular basis without having regular personal one-on-one access to the president. But when you cover someone the rest of your career in journalism, it's much easier to say, there's something I'm curious about. I'd love to spend 10 or 15 minutes sitting down with this person who I cover and really sort of suss out the nuance in what he's thinking. And that's not how our job works day to day. Even talking to the people closest to him who help him shape his thinking and decisions requires a lot of cajoling and requesting and appointment making and trying to grab people when you see them, you know, slip outside or enter the gate, or you're on a trip and there they are 30 feet away on the tarmac and you're like, hey, I've been trying to catch up to you. And they have that look in their eyes like, oh, great, uh-oh, you got me. Yeah, there it is.
And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with two members of the White House Press Corps. Tamara Keith is a White House correspondent for NPR, and Margaret Talev is the White House correspondent for Bloomberg. And how about dropping in, Margaret, just to visit with White House Press Secretary Jay Carney? How often does that happen?
He's very accessible. When he's around and one of us is around, we have our press, our hard pass gets us access. We go through the lower press office, press a little automatic button, and a little pocket door slides open. And then we go up a set of stairs past a Secret Service agent and into the upper press office where Jay's office is. And he's a very warm guy. Whenever he's available, he's there for you. If he's not available, his assistant is really, really helpful and will help us schedule that. And that's a great thing to be able to do. But, you know, getting in to see the chief of staff is a little bit harder, or a deputy chief of staff, or, you know, senior counselor or advisor, someone like John Podesta or Valerie Jarrett. Dan Pfeiffer is pretty accessible, but really, really busy. But it is sort of beyond that communications level at the real decision-making level. If there's someone in the National Security Council, for example, who is a real expert on counterterrorism or factions in Syria, yeah, good luck getting to see that guy unless the press staff wants you to see that guy.
Yeah. You know, why should, you know, Tamara, why should the president hold more news conferences? Because, you know, after all, if he flubs up, you know, and that's happened more than a few times, it's a huge headache for him. So what's the argument to do them more often?
Well, because we want it. No, you know,
I get that.
because creating those opportunities, you know, as much as there's an opportunity for him to flub up, there's also an opportunity for him to get his message across in a way that is more compelling than just his spokesman doing it. So I think from their perspective, I mean, they're weighing the risk and benefit, and they've decided that the risks outweigh the benefits, I guess. For us, seeing the man himself say the words, I think it has a lot of value, news value. And you know, I find myself going back and rewatching or rereading a press conference he did back in December to try to get some insights about what is driving his decisions now. You know, I do feel like hearing the president speak actually does, in a non-scripted way, is extremely valuable in defining stories.
Hmm. You know, Margaret, tell us, you guys have alluded to this as well during our time together today. Tell us about your workspaces at the White House, because I've heard you guys say it. I've read about these cubby holes that you guys work in, and even that might be putting it a little bit generously.
Well, let me preface all that by saying that it really is, as Tam mentioned in the beginning of our segment, when you walk in through those White House gates, regardless of who the president is and regardless of whether you're having, like, the most amazing day or kind of a it's still, like, sort of the center of where politics and policy and major American decisions all happen. And if you cover politics, it really is a privilege to be able to work there at all, even if you're in the basement and it's moldy and there's mice scurrying around, which actually happens a lot after rainstorms. So what happens is you walk in through the gate. We have a pass. The pass basically gets us in through the gate and up to the upper press office, and that's it. It doesn't allow us to wander the halls of you know, the West Wing or the residence or anything like that. But we badge in with our pass, type in our codes, put all of our stuff through a magnometer so that they can make sure we're not carrying any weapons other than pens and pads. And then we sort of meander this path along what's called Pebble Beach, where the television networks have their cameras stationed. And if you're watching TV news, you'll see sometimes that sort of classic shot of the reporter on camera with the White House behind them. We walk past that area around the sort of roundabout where you'll see a Marine Guard station when the president's in the Oval Office, and just between there and sort of the main residence and the East Room and all that stuff is kind of a short squat part of the White House compound, and that is the press area. So you walk in through a side door, you walk into that briefing room that you've seen on TV. It's about a third the size of how it appears on TV. Huh. It's blue. And then if you turn left and cut through the briefing room, you're in the workspace, and there's two floors of workspace. Most of the Associated Press and Reuters and most of the television networks are in that upper area, and then there's a basement area where some cable, all of the radio, and Bloomberg and many individual newspapers are located. So there's sort of two floors worth of cubbies. Some of them are glassed in for the networks and the wire services and the radio. And for newspapers, they're just sort of open workspaces. No privacy, very hard to talk to a source. And so in the middle of the day, you'll see people outside on their cell phones kind of tipped against the wind or sweating it out because they're trying to talk to someone who they don't want to talk to in front of 20 other people downstairs.
Huh. But yes, we're in the basement. In short, we're in the basement.
And everything that implies, you're in the basement, yeah. I should point out that Margaret Taleff, again, she's Bloomberg's news, a White House correspondent. She'll be speaking at the Block School of Management here at UMKC at 5:30 Wednesday afternoon. Information's available through our website at kcur.org. Tamara, a typical day for you two is what exactly? When do you arrive? When do you head home?
Well, so I start by getting my little kid ready for school and getting him off to school, and he's 18 months, so school might be generous.
Yes.
And then I take the metro in, and so I actually get in around 9:30. Things oddly, in Washington, at times seem to get rolling a little bit slowly in the morning, but that's probably because we're up so darn late working. Mm. And often what happens is I come in, sort of figure out what I'm trying to do for the day. The briefing is supposed to be around lunchtime. Sometimes it doesn't start until 1:15, which means it doesn't end until about 2. That's sort of the middle of the cycle. That's when I should be writing, for all things considered. So there's a lot of, like, wait, hurry that happens. And then a lot of times I will leave around 6, go home, get the little guy in bed, and keep working until 11.
Wow. At home, then, you're working.
At home, networked in. But the reality, and you know, at 8:30, some memo will come out or something will break. I mean, something is happening all the time. I got home from covering the Olympics in Sochi. I wasn't even back to work yet. And all of this Crimea stuff was blowing up. And, you know, I'm barely recovered from jet lag. And I'm, you know, confirming that there was a call between Putin and the president on a Saturday.
Wow.
And that is absolutely a normal part of the job. That's what you sign up for. And in some ways that would be, oh, that's not glamorous. But if you're like a total news junkie, that's the best thing ever, is to actually have news forcing you to work.
Well, it sounds like spectacular jobs that you two have. I'm Steve Kraske. We're talking to two members of the White House Press Corps, Margaret Talov of Bloomberg and Tamara Keith of NPR. Tamara, how aware of you are you of what other White House correspondents are doing, what stories they're working on each day, and to what extent does that sort of tend to get, how much can that rattle you as you figure out what you're going to do during the course of your day?
Well, I don't know what they're working on typically when they're working on it, but I certainly know about it when it hits. And if it's a really big, good story, then I, you know, then there's a little wishing it was me and a little pushing to do something different next time or not. It just sort of depends. But, you know, if somebody's working on something that's really going to blow the roof off the place, they're not typically going to brag about it beforehand. But, you know, the way we function now with Twitter and social media, if somebody has something big, you know about it right away once it's out.
Margaret, how much do you fear getting scooped by somebody else?
Well, at Bloomberg, you know, we really put a premium on important financial news that moves markets. If it's about major U.S. corporations, if it's about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And so while my focus on the beat is on foreign policy, I always have an eye toward foreign policy as it may affect business, the economy, corporations. Our readers are interested in a broader range of things, but that's the core of what makes Bloomberg special. So I'm always looking to have an edge on that sort of news. But all of us are generalists, even those of us who are trying to be specialists in one area. Look, it's like drinking out of a fire hose every day. So at any given time, we may all be working on, you know, covering the minimum wage, what's going on in the Ukraine, what's happening in Syria, what's happening in the 2014 midterms, Obama's relationship with Boehner, what's going to happen to Mary Landrieu, whether the guy in Iowa screwed it up for the whole Democratic Party. So you're juggling all of this stuff and at the same time really trying to break through on sort of a special bead that you may be following. It can be really challenging, but it's also really fun if you like adrenaline and the chase and to kind of constantly be teaching yourself new things. But again, for most of us, most of us are generalists, even if there's a special area that we're interested in.
You know, I'm wondering about a White House news conference and the choreography that tends to go into those things.
You know, let's do this. Yeah, that's fun.
How do you get to ask a question? And is there a certain order in which the president tends to ask those questions, Tamara?
Oh, well, so I'm going to have to defer to Margaret because I have not actually been in the room for a presidential press conference yet. I've been in the room for many Jay Carney press conferences, and I can tell you all about that. And also, I can tell you that we typically know in advance if our organization is going to get a question in a press conference or if there's a decent chance that we're going to get a question, because we'll get this email saying, who's going to be sitting in the NPR chair today? And that's your sign to make sure you have a really good question ready, because the president might call on you. I have not been in that chair yet. I believe it is just a matter of time.
Margaret?
So you know, I've had a question a few times, and again, you really don't know whether you're going to get called on or not until perhaps earlier, like, you know, within an hour or so of the news conference, you may get a note trying to confirm who it is that'll be there for your organization. And again, that usually is a signal that he's likely to call on you, although sometimes he goes out of order or off script. But as a general rule, he'll have a list of the people he's going to call on, but there's no bargaining for the question. There's no pre-submission of anything like that. And I would go into any news conference with 6 or 7 questions prepared because, again, even if you do get sort of a tip, an early tip, it's not much of lead time. And you don't know in what order he will be calling on people, and you don't know who else he'll be calling on. So you'll see a mad scrambling of reporters whispering, "Have you heard who's going to get a question?" You know, that sort of thing. And you want to make sure that even if you get called on, if it's a big news conference, I mean, he could take 10 questions. If it's a overseas news conference, usually it might be 2 questions from the U.S. press, 2 questions from the other side. So you try to have enough diversity of your questions prepared that if someone else takes the 3 or 4 questions that you thought were better, you're not like, ugh.
Yeah.
And I just want to toss in, Margaret, she's talking about a foreign press conference. I don't remember the exact circumstances, but she got one of the 2 questions at this press conference that the president was having with another foreign leader. And she asked all 6 of her questions. It was like a 6-part question. And that's sort of the way it's become in those types of press conferences. And it was an absolutely valuable service because she got a few answers, which it was important, but she was just like, and then part B, A, C.
Well, so what's happened is because these news conferences are relatively rare, at least the big ones, where your domestic ones, where you get a crack at a lot of questions, you're sort of sometimes you're on a foreign trip and you know that the foreign leader who he's standing next to, you know, doesn't really care about what's going on in Congress, but you might need to ask a question about the minimum wage or whether or not, you know, we're going to go over the fiscal cliff or what happens to immigration reform. But also maybe you're in Israel or maybe, you know, you're getting ready to head into a summit with the Russians. So you got to ask the foreign policy question and the domestic question. So we have some tactics. And one of my favorite ones, if I can share a little hint with anyone who might need to ask a question of the president under pressure, is you ask 2 questions, 1 to the president, and then you ask the 2nd question to the foreign leader. But it's the sort of question that the president is not going to let just the foreign leader answer and him not answer. And so he ends up answering both your questions and then grimacing and complaining about how the press really needs to stop doing this. But part of the reason why we've turned to this tactic is because it's really hard to get the question time. And so you're trying to walk a fine. You don't want to be obnoxious. You don't want to put the, you know, president on the spotlight for 8 questions in a row. But I have managed to get 3 in.
Well, Margaret, when you do that, and given how rare this has been during this administration, are these questions solely your own, or are you bouncing them by your colleagues and perhaps your editors at Bloomberg to sort of figure out, hey, if we get a question, this is what we should be asking?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we don't have like a hard and fast rule on this, but in the spirit of collaboration and team playing, I always, if I am going to be the person in the chair, I will circulate a note, and so will my other 6 people on the Bloomberg White House team, because it's a wire service. We cover the White House 24/7. So if one of us is going to be in the chair, we'll always pass around a note saying, "This is what I was thinking about asking. What do you guys think? Or how do you think it would be smart to word it?" You don't want to ask a question in such an open-ended way that it allows sort of filibustering or a wide, you know, exposition on something. You're trying to get to if you're trying to get to a specific question, it's really important that you choose the words carefully to convey what you're really asking. And then if it's a foreign press conference, as a courtesy, because there's only going to be 1 or 2 U.S. questions, if I'm in the pool with the other journalists from competing news organizations, we don't know which one of us is going to get the question until such a short time before. Yeah. We'll often sit in the van together and sort of collaborate. What do you guys think we should go after? Yeah.
And we are back for the final segment of our conversation with our 2 White House correspondents, Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg and Tamara Keith of NPR. You know, we've been talking about how glamorous this position of White House correspondent is, but you also get a sense that in this era of, you know, intense gridlock, that the significance of Congress and, in fact, the significance of the presidency has been devalued because so little work of real substance is getting done these days. Tamara, do you sense that each day as you cover this president?
You know, I think that this is an interesting time for this presidency, as it would be for any presidency, in part because it's a second term, in part because this Congress is looking to the 2015 or 2014 elections, because all of the really hot political discussion right now is about who's running in 2016. And so this president is in this position where he's doing very incremental things. The big news today was that the president is going to be signing some executive orders this week related to equal pay for federal contractors. This is pretty incremental, small ball kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It sort of it forces us to think about how we want to cover those things. And it's sort of an ongoing struggle that we have to try to figure out what to bring to our audience that will be valuable and interesting to them. And it's a struggle that the president he's trying to figure out how to make a difference, how to stay relevant, what he can do as president, because he still is the most powerful man in the world, while also not having a cooperative Congress and not having the kind of political capital and approval ratings that would allow him to do whatever he wants.
I think that's right. But I also think on the question of devaluation, I think that the gridlock devalues Congress much more than it does the president and the White House. Mm-hmm. In terms of foreign policy, he still has wide berth to make a lot of decisions. And you know, the old notion that politics stops at the water's edge, I don't know if that's true anymore. I'd argue it's not entirely true anymore, but it's still really different, the extent to which your congressional critics would obstruct you on domestic policy versus on foreign policy. But I do think that it is harder to make bipartisan deals than it used to be. But if you look at what this administration has done, although he's not been able to accomplish a lot of the things he wanted to, you'd be hard-pressed to argue that Obamacare doesn't have the potential to be a major change in U.S. healthcare policy. And in terms of environmental policy, in terms of policy for gay rights, and in terms of extending and tweaking and modifying, but really codifying the post-9/11 approach to dealing with terrorism, counterterrorism, drones, the president has done an awful lot of stuff, even in this age of congressional gridlock. If I can just digress for one second, you were talking about the glamour of the beat, and I wanted to tell you and your listeners, if you heard rustling right as we came back, as soon as we went off for the last segment of the pledge drive, I got a frantic note from the White House saying, I need you to scan me a copy of two IDs for your Korea credentialing process. It's due like now. And so during our break, fiddling with my iPhone, and I had my passes out, and Tamara's like, what are you doing? And I'm taking these pictures and trying to go make the glare go away so that I can email it so that I can get a credential for a visa.
Well, Margaret, but then, did you have an ambition when you were a little girl to become a White House correspondent?
Did I? No, I wanted to. Well, yes and no. That was never really my ambition. I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. Sort of got sidetracked in American politics and never got out the door, except for White House travel allows me to do an awful lot of foreign travel. So it's really been a wonderful surprise. But my first crush on a guy was Walter Cronkite when I was about 1.5, 2 years old. And it was really deep and I think true love and abiding. And it did shape. I was like a dork when I was a little kid. We watched the nightly news, and I had a crush on Howard Baker at one point. This is like too much TMI, but I was really, really interested in American politics always, and always interested in foreign policy. So you would think that I would have had a lifelong plan to end up where I am now, but it really happened by a bunch of happy coincidences and accidents. And I have a couple friends in the White House press corps who this is their dream and they wanted it since they were 10 years old. And for me, it was more like I loved covering politics. I loved covering foreign policy. I got assigned to cover Obama back when he looked like the candidate who was going to be sort of an interesting side issue in 2008, and stumbled into covering the guy who would go on to become president. So that's how it happened.
Well, Margaret, I've got about a minute left. What's your story there?
Oh, that was Margaret.
I'm getting my White House correspondence mixed up here.
So what is my story? You know, I as a young sprout watched MTV News covering the presidential election, and I wanted to cover presidential races for MTV News. Then I realized I actually wanted to do it for NPR, and have sort of at times been on and off that track. But when the White House position opened up, it was just like, yes, like, yes, that's it. That's sort of where this has all been headed. So it's pretty cool.
Well, what's the ratio of male White House correspondents to female?
There's
roughly
more men than women, but it's not like
not overwhelming.
It's not grievously so. Sometimes we'll be on Air Force One, and this is not true for the photographers, but for the correspondents and everyone, the TV producer, the wire representatives, the print, the magazine seat, everyone will be women. And we all look around and say, girl power. And, you know, it's a lot different than it was even 10 or 15 years ago.
So things are changing.
They are, but you know, along with that comes a lot of childcare juggling for the men as well as the women. It's like, oh, I gotta be back for a press conference. And Blackberries are a blessing and a curse, but the Blackberries and the iPhones and the iPads have allowed us to take this job home with us, take it into for the bath at night, and as you're doing the tucking in, you're lying next to my kid reading her a story, and you can hear the little Blackberry going, you know, 9:30, 9:45, 10 o'clock. But the evolution of this is there's a lot more women who cover the White House and a lot more men who are active dads and cover the White House. And it's everybody juggling everything. It's very modern.
And I feel like we're talking about it all the time. Like, that's what we're talking about in the basement in the briefing room. Yeah. It's like, what is your childcare solution?
Well, again, Margaret, tell if folks can hear her on Wednesday, 5:30 in the afternoon at the Black School of Management at UMKC. Information
come see
for that, kcur.org. And Margaret, you don't know this, but we're having lunch on Wednesday. And I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you don't know this, but I'm looking forward to talking about our McClatchy common history. So
that sounds great. That sounds great. I want to thank again Margaret Talov of Bloomberg and Tamara Keith of NPR. You guys have been great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.